Welcome to Sex Unshackled. I am Becky Krepsley Fox, and this podcast is where sexuality and spirituality meet. Today on Sex Unshackled, I have Iris Josephina from Cycle Seeds with me. Iris is a certified hormonal health coach, functional hormone specialist, orthomolecular advisor and birth worker with an academic background in medical anthropology and women's studies. She also qualified in holistic women's health, traditional midwifery practices, and trauma-informed coaching. Now, I cannot wait for this conversation. Iris, can you kick us off by sharing what brought you to this work?
Thank you so much for having me, first of all.
Pleasure.
I'm excited to be here. So my story is multi-layered. So on the one hand, there is the more professional side that brought me to this work. And then there is my own personal story with hormonal birth control. So let me just start with the professional side. I was studying to become a cultural anthropologist with specialization in medical anthropology. And I was in India researching pregnancy experiences amongst women there. So how do they experience their pregnant body? How do they learn about their body? And I ended up witnessing births there during my research. I was very young. I was 22 years old, and it was all very new. But, you know, witnessing a birth is such a profound experience. And one of the first people I saw giving birth was actually my age. So I had bonded with her during my research and we were the same age and we connected. And witnessing the birth of her baby was just one of the most profound experiences, like core memory immediately. And when I got back from my research, I could not let it go. I was like, I need to do something with birth. I want to work in birth. And I didn't want to like take on the entire, you know, 5 years of studying to become a midwife. So I chose to become a doula, because as a doula, you don't need to have like the medical responsibilities, but you still get to support people in this beautiful sacred process that is birth and pregnancy and postpartum. So I started working as a doula, did my training, started working. And through my work as a doula, I actually realized that people don't know so much about their bodies, even when they are like university trained, like PhD, they did not know anything. And I was just teaching basic biology to highly educated, middle income class people in my own country. And I was like, how is this possible? Like, how? So that is why now I actually got frustrated. It's like, this needs to be different. Like, people need to have this knowledge before they get pregnant so that they're not so scared when they get pregnant because they don't know what's going on in their bodies. And I was like, if we understand our bodies like from a very foundational perspective before we get pregnant, it's so much easier and so much less overwhelming. So that's when I started learning about menstrual cycles, fertility, menstrual issues. So I went to a conference by the Society for Menstrual Cycle Research, and that's really where I found like my people. It was like 300 people all obsessed by the menstrual cycle. And I was like, wow, these are like my people. And I started studying with some of my mentors there. So they would just teach me one-to-one in their own free time. I was their student. And only after that, I started to embarking on like the actual educational training journey to become a hormonal health coach. But in the meantime, while all of this happened, like before my research in India, I was on the pill until I was 22 years old. I started when I was 15, and I was on it until I was 22. So this was like, right, I was on the pill right until I went to India, actually, for my research. And before that, I had such, you know, terrible acne, terrible gut issues. I felt a lot of times like very low when I was on the pill. And before I went to India, I was studying at UCLA in America in an exchange program, and I had access to all these databases, all this research, all these books. And I just started researching on my own because I was like, how is it possible that my gynae, she told me like, oh yeah, all the things you experience are like a side effect of the pill. Don't worry about it. I was like, what? Like, do I have to go through all of this just because I don't want to have a baby? That didn't seem right.
Yeah.
So I went on this journey just out of pure curiosity and not feeling that it was fair. And I just read like all I could. And at the time that this is like 2012, like at the time there was like only research articles. There were no like mainstream books about this yet. So I just researched on my own, and the things that I learned there also kind of like sparked the rest of my journey. So yeah, that's a bit of my personal story, and it all went organically. Like I always thought like I would be a medical anthropologist with a PhD teaching at a university. Like that was my vision, but life had other plans for me. So yeah, it all went really organically.
Yeah. And this almost disbelief that you felt when you're working with people and realize they don't know about their own bodies, this is similar to how I felt when I started working in the sex field, because people don't know about their sexual organs, their sexual function. They don't have basic sexual health education.
No, it's all connected. Like when we start learning about menstrual cycles and when we start becoming more body literate, obviously we will also be learning about our genitals and our sexuality and our experience of our sexuality, because that can shift and change in our various life cycles throughout our menstrual cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm so interested in this time that you spent in India. I'm just wondering, mainly for my own curiosity, are there any differences that you witnessed through pregnancy and labor in India than where you live and work now? And is there anything that we can learn from each other about this?
I think the most profound and also heartbreaking thing that I learned in India is that people, okay, so I witnessed these births in what they call primary health centers, which are tiny health centers that you can compare to like a doctor's practice. And then you have secondary health centers, which are a little bit bigger, and then you have hospitals. So the healthcare system in India is a bit different, and it's, you know, it's been like 11 years ago, so maybe it has changed right now. But the births that I witnessed were in primary health center, and then I went to see some of my informants in the hospital because they were transferred from the primary health center to the hospital. And the heartbreaking thing that I learned there is that every single person I spoke to reported to me that in earlier times, things were better. Like when there were no hospitals, when there were no healthcare centers, there was the midwife, and women would just give birth like in the field or at home, and their family was there, and the family was cooking for them. And, you know, one of these people had to go to the hospital, which was like a 2-hour bus ride away from the village.
Ugh.
And so the entire family had to come with like all their food to the hospital, but the hospital was not like a nice room and a bed. It was just like literally a square room, very small. The woman who gave birth was sitting on the floor. Her baby was not with her because it was in an incubator, and the entire family was there. But there were 3 patients who had their entire family there. So it was just like this square room with a lot of people and no space to breathe, no room. And thank goodness these people brought like their own food. But everybody reported back to me like in earlier times, it was better because we could stay at home. But then there was no like agency or understanding that even though these hospitals exist, they can still stay home. Like people don't do that anymore because they say like, oh, the midwives are so old, they're in their 90s, they don't work anymore, and the only option for us is to go to the hospital because that's where the doctors and the support are. But it was really heartbreaking for me to hear that, because the value was really like in that community-based birthing, but the options are not there anymore. And also the profession of midwifery is like slowly dying because everybody values the medical system. So there is also a great part of knowledge that just has been lost. And it's really heartbreaking to have witnessed that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awfully sad. And I've actually been reading some books about pregnancy, mainly by authors in the UK, and they're talking about something similar, about how in the UK, birthing has become so medicalized. And actually, some of the stats show that if people are able to have home births, then they're less likely to need forceps or episiotomies. They're less likely to have these kind of smaller medical interventions. And them being in a hospital increases the likelihood of them having these interventions, which I'm finding quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's also because these interventions are only available at the hospital. So obviously they will be,
they're gonna do that. Yeah.
You know, the threshold to use an intervention or to be submitted to an intervention, the chance is really big in a hospital because it's available. At a home birth, you don't have it available. Even if you would want to have like pain relief at home, they can't give that to you because it's something that they only offer at the hospital. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I know you talk about fertility and it being more than making babies. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, it's really important for people to understand that a fertile body is a body that ovulates regularly and has a period about 14 to 17 days after ovulation. And ovulation is the most important event of a menstrual cycle, and the quality, frequency, and consistency of ovulation and all the hormones that have to work together to make this process happen, they actually have a ton of other functions in the body. And many people are not aware of that. So regular ovulation and a well-functioning endocrine system, which is a well-functioning hormone system in a fertile body, contribute to a healthier circadian rhythm, which means your sleep and waking rhythm, a well-functioning digestive system and metabolism, optimal bone density, cognitive function, brain well-being, but also cardiovascular health and wellness, weight maintenance and stress management, and obviously human development and growth when we get pregnant. But it's really about so much more, and it's really important to have all of our hormones in place and have a well-functioning endocrine system, because it literally affects all these other systems in the body. Like, we have hormone receptors from top to bottom. Like, all cells in our bodies have hormone receptors. So obviously they're going to affect everything in our body and not just our gonads or, you know, our ovaries or our womb. Like, I don't understand why some people think that. I think it's because we don't know enough about biology. But it's very crucial that our hormone function is optimal, because it actually protects our health as well. If we have a very disrupted endocrine system, this will also impact our ability with which we can make babies. So our ability to conceive, our ability to stay pregnant and not lose a pregnancy. It also impacts our birth. It also impacts our postpartum period. And a well-functioning endocrine system also determines how smoothly you will move into perimenopause and menopause. So it's very important that our hormones are in optimal condition so it can protect our overall health, because we have these hormone receptors all over the body that help us function in a way that our body is meant to function.
So what actually is a hormone? Because I know when I speak to people, I often hear something to the effect of they feel like their hormones are working against them. They see that their hormones is something that's happening to them rather than it being a part of them. So what actually is going on?
So, I like to think of hormones as your body's chemical messengers. They travel in from your brain to your brain actually gives the commands, and hormones travel in your bloodstream to various tissues and organs. They work slowly, and over time, they affect things like growth and development, your metabolism, so how your body gets energy from foods. Your sexual function, your reproduction, your mood, and you have endocrine glands all over your body, which are like specific, special groups of cells that make hormones. So these glands create hormones. So the major endocrine glands are your pituitary gland in your brain, your thymus, your thyroid, your adrenal glands, which make your stress hormones, and your pancreas. And then obviously in our bodies, we have our ovaries. So yeah. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's for
What
me. That's
hormones
very
there?
clear. Yeah. So, how can we work with the hormones rather than against them? How can we create this like healthy functioning of hormones? How can we aid that?
So I'd also want to mention that our hormones actually come in tiers of importance. So there is various like kinds of hormones, and they all get like priority. And the ones that get the most priority are cortisol and insulin. Then we have pregnenolone and DHEA. And then we have our thyroid hormones, our melatonin, our sex hormones. So our bodies will prioritize some hormones over others, and we can see it as like this little upside down pyramid. Like if your cortisol and your insulin are out of whack, it'll impact your pregnenolone and your DHEA, and that will then impact your sex hormones and your thyroid hormones and your melatonin, which is the hormone that helps you fall asleep. So we have to look at hormones as this entire system that works together, and they're all like the hormone headquarters is in your brain. And there are many ways in which we can disrupt our hormones. And actually, what I see in my practice the most is that the most common problem that I see when people experience hormonal problems, which are the last one in the tier, in the category, is actually a blood sugar and a cortisol problem. So stress and blood sugar dysregulation. Though these two are the biggest culprits when it comes to hormonal health. And when I look at my clients, we always have to like travel back. So we have to work with the complaints that they are having now, but then we have to like work everything backwards to make sure, like, okay, what is the root cause of you experiencing this right now? And how can we support this? So this is also why, when we are talking about our sex hormones, we always have to look at our cortisol, so our stress hormones, and our insulin, our blood sugar. So when we look at hormonal healing, we cannot leave out stress management and blood sugar regulation, because they literally will impact how our hormones will respond. And like I said before, we have hormone receptors all over our body, which also means we have insulin receptors on our ovaries. So if our blood sugar is dysregulated and our insulin receptors cannot function properly, this is not going to have only an effect on our metabolism, but also directly on our sex hormones, because we literally have the receptors on our ovaries. So I'd like to, invite everybody to think about hormones as like this ecosystem in the body that needs to work together, and everything impacts everything. We cannot just look at, oh, sex hormones as the separate category, but it's literally all connected. And this is also why shifting and changing nutrition, and thus how our body responds to glucose, has such an immense impact on our sex hormones as well. Does that make sense when I explain it like that?
To me, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. Oof, there's a lot there. So you personally, how do you connect with your menstrual cycle? How do you connect with your fertility?
Oh, I have many ways. I have many ways to connect with my menstrual cycle and my fertility. And I really mark the different phases of my cycle because I chart my cycle. I take my temperature, my cervical fluid, and the position of my cervix. So that's one practice, the fertility awareness method that really shows me and teaches me, like, okay, this is where I am in my menstrual cycle. And then from a more spiritual perspective, like I have this little shell on my altar, and I'll put like a different color stone for each phase of my cycle because I think it's just really sweet to do. And it's just like this little awareness thing that I do for myself. And then during my period, I really try to not use any products that are harmful so that I can really like witness my blood in my period underwear or my washable pads or my menstrual cup. And I also give my blood back to the plants. Maybe that's a little bit weird for some people, but I really feel it's important that we like complete the cycle. Like we are part of an ecosystem, we're part of the earth, and our menstrual blood can literally support a baby to grow. So for me, it doesn't feel right to just, chuck that away, but use it, to give back to the earth. And I'll either give it to my house plants or outside when I'm out for a hike, or
I hear it makes plants flourish as well. I hear it's really good for them.
it actually has all the vital nutrients that you can also find in like generic fertilizers.
It's awesome. So, as we know, sexual desire kind of ebbs and flows for people who have wombs over the course of the month and, well, over a course of a lifetime as well. But I don't know, can you tell the listeners a little bit about why sexual desire might flow throughout their cycle?
The menstrual cycle has four main phases. So your menstrual phase, your follicular phase, your ovulation phase, and your luteal phase. And your hormones fluctuate during these various phases. And there is certain hormones that'll be dominant in a certain phase and others that'll be a little bit lower in a certain phase. I think the three hormones I would love to talk about are estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, because they are truly connected to our sexual desire. So if we let me just go into the hormones first and then into the phases. So when we're talking estrogen, estrogen keeps vaginal tissues lubricated and plump and increases desire towards ovulation and literally makes sex more pleasurable. So estrogen is really responsible to keep the vagina juicy, if I can say it like that. Progesterone is the hormone that more like keeps us calm. It's our natural antidepressant. It reduces PMS symptoms and it helps us sleep well. And I feel that sleep is so crucial for people with menstrual cycles. Sleep can actually help us to increase our sexual desire. Like when we sleep more, we feel more vital and we feel, more active.
I'll start
But
giving
then,
that as the homework to my clients. Sleeping more sounds fantastic.
but higher levels of progesterone can adversely impact sex drive. So it's really the estrogen that is, very important for a sex drive. And obviously, we also have testosterone, even though that is more considered like a male hormone. Like estrogen, testosterone spikes mid-cycle, and estrogen and testosterone actually work together to boost sex drive. And it's also said that testosterone and adequate levels of testosterone actually improve our experience of our orgasm. So higher levels of testosterone, like within the normal ranges that are healthy, may improve our experience of orgasm.
That sounds awesome.
So when we then look at the various phases in our cycle, so after our periods, we have our follicular phase, which is the first part of our cycle. And our follicular phase actually already starts around day three of our cycle, because that's when FSH and estrogen already begin to rise. And in the beginning, your body is like slow in producing. So when estrogen is low, people may have less desire for sex because estrogen is lower. But in the later follicular phase, energy levels and sexual desire increase for many people, especially as you get closer to ovulation. And it isn't that, you know, you just may feel more mentally into the idea of sex, but physically you're also like more ready. Your vagina is more lubricated. You'll have naturally engorged vaginal tissue and just a heightened sensitivity thanks to estrogen. So I see that people are most, you know, ready and desire sex the most at the end of the follicular phase and then around ovulation. And ovulation is really, on average, the midpoint of the cycle. This, I have to say, this varies per person, like the day of the cycle within which you ovulate. But ovulation is really when a surge of estrogen triggers the production of luteinizing hormone, which then signals the release of the egg from your ovaries. That's what ovulation is. And as an like evolutionary adaptation, this fertile window that we experience around ovulation will also increase our drive for sex, because it's the highest probability that we can conceive. Like, we're still animals and our bodies are still, we're still built. Like, even if we're not in the baby making era of our lives, the sex hormones secreted during this time will increase your libido, and even your ability to orgasm because of what testosterone is doing. Maybe a fun thing to mention, because I recently read about this, there has been research that shows that masturbation also peaks mid-cycle for most people. Like, if we track when people masturbate in their menstrual cycle, mid-cycle, around ovulation, around the fertile window, this is a time where masturbation and self-pleasure like peaks. And I think that's really cool.
I can believe that.
Yeah. So a thing that I do want to add is that even though our bodies are primed to have higher desire and have more sex around ovulation, for some people, this can also lead to feeling less inclined to have sex because they may have a fear to become pregnant. So, you know, when people are very aware that they can fall pregnant because they're not on any form of birth control and they haven't like nailed fertility awareness methods, or condoms have broken in the past and they've had like experiences of unwanted pregnancy or maybe abortion, I really do want to say that it is possible that you do not feel like having sex mid-cycle because of your experiences, and that's totally okay too.
Yeah.
So, and this like simultaneously may also potentially explain why masturbation is so high mid-cycle, because obviously with masturbation doesn't come pregnancy.
Yeah, much safer way to explore yeah. that sexual side of yourself.
Yeah, so I really wanted to mention that. And then in the luteal phase after ovulation, like right after ovulation, we may still have like this higher sex drive as estrogen and testosterone slowly come down. But usually in the luteal phase, like a little bit after, let's say a week after ovulation, our sexual desire may decline. And I have seen that in my practice too. I've experienced that myself too. Estrogen is lower in this phase. Progesterone is higher. Testosterone is lower. This can lead to the vagina feeling more dry and making sex potentially more painful for some people if the vagina isn't properly lubricated. So I also always tell people, if you need lube in the luteal phase, please use extra lube, because your higher progesterone levels may invite to use more lube. And it may also be harder to orgasm because of this hormonal makeup. So when progesterone is higher, it may be a little bit harder to achieve orgasm or experience orgasms that are not as intense and juicy as you may experience them around ovulation. And I think this is important for people to know that this is a normal thing to happen. Like, you're not broken. There is not something wrong with you if this happens to you. And, you know, in your luteal phase, you may have some PMS symptoms. You may have some mood changes. You may feel more fatigued and just not in a mood. And that's fine. And some people also have a heightened sense of smell, a heightened sense of taste, and a heightened sensitivity for touch. So for some people, sex may be just overwhelming in the luteal phase, especially if your hormones are a little bit out of whack, or you have some PMS, or you have PMDD. It's all possible and it's normal. And I really invite people to explore with themselves and observe in themselves, like, how is that for you? Like, how does your sexual desire shift and change throughout your cycle? And just track that for a couple of cycles so that you really learn, like, what is your normal? And when do you feel most, you know, desire for sex? And when do you feel less desire? And that's fine. Then you can do like other things with your partner or alone. And that's okay. We are not the same person every single day because we have an endocrine system. And it's normal that we don't desire the same things every single day.
So if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, oh, well, my desire doesn't really change. Maybe they have higher desire. Maybe they have lower desire where they don't really notice it. From a hormonal perspective, is there a time where they should maybe go to the doctor or get something checked?
Yeah, I would say if sex is really painful and your vagina is just like chronically super dry and it's never pleasurable for you and you have pain during or after an orgasm or just pain in general, or you just feel that you're like so far away from your sexual desire, that will all be indications to like visit a doctor or visit a functional medicine practitioner or orthomolecular doctor or practitioner. Because what could happen then is that your estrogens are just so low that your body may need a little bit of support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would you want the listener's main takeaway to be from listening to this episode? What do you really want to highlight and put out there?
I would love for everybody to cultivate a curiosity for their own bodies and their own cycles. And all bodies are unique. Like, what I shared today is like the average way in which a menstrual cycle and desire can flow. But please know that your body is super unique, and it's my invitation to become body literate about your own body. Like, learn your body, learn your ebbs and flows. Learn what is normal for you so that you are also aware when something is off, when something just doesn't feel right for you, and you'll know. And I also want to encourage you that if you feel something is off, you're probably right. Mm-hmm. Like, we're often so much like shamed or talked out of our intuition when something is off. And I'm always like, when you feel something is off, like 99% of the time, you're right. And it's really important to like stand by your own feeling and not leave any doctor's office, any therapist's office until you've had an answer that satisfies you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Where can the listeners find you?
I am mostly on Instagram over at Cycle Seeds. My website is cycleseeds.com. I also have a podcast, the Planting Seeds podcast, and I'm currently offering a holistic hormone and cycle coaching certification training that has a separate website that you can find through my Instagram as well.
Amazing. I'm going to post all of them in the show notes page so people can find you easily. Thank you so much for coming. It's been such a joy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to be here.